Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.
Pleased to see the FRIB project happening all of about three blocks from us here at WKAR has received another important approval from the U.S. Department of Energy. According to the State Journal, it fixes the cost of the project, which is $730 million, and it determines who is going to pay how much, the feds so much, MSU under $100 million of that total, as best as I can tell. And that is all well and good, but a Whole Foods is coming to East Lansing. Get back. We are covering both ends of the spectrum with this, you realize. We got the organic on one end and we got the nuclear on the other. Talk about covering all of your bases. Later this hour, a couple of participants in the World Dwarf Games here at Michigan State over the next 7 days. And we'll also talk with a couple of Lansing neighborhood leaders about the at-large contest for city council involving two incumbents and four challengers. That's all coming up here on Friday's Current State. This summer's been busier than usual at the state capitol, with ongoing discussions happening on hot-button issues, including Medicaid expansion, Common Core education standards, road funding, and more. Here to offer his perspective on those and others is a Democratic East Lansing State Representative Sam Singh of the 69th District. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thank you for having me back.
How do you feel about having a Whole Foods coming to your district?
Well, when I was mayor in East Lansing, that was actually one of the things that constituents would come to me. And technically, I think the Whole Foods will be in Meridian Township, but it's great for the region, great for Michigan State University, and I think people are going to look forward to additional choices where they can shop.
According to the State Journal's treatment of the story, Mr. Tesseris, the developer, has been talking with the company for maybe 3 years or so. And this is something that's been on your agenda for even longer than that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there has always been an interest by the region, not just East Lansing, but I know out in Meridian Township as well, to have additional options when you take a look at fresh food. And I think this is going to be a great complement to the other places that we already have here in the region.
As the vice chair of the House Committee on Common Core, I have to open with this talk, and this is in the earliest stages, I believe, talk among the governor and the legislative leaders, the so-called quadrants leaders, of a statewide ballot proposal to increase the state sales tax and earmarking that revenue to roads, not just to roads, but to education as well. What do you know?
Well, you know, we've just heard basically this concept. Prior to this, the conversation has been taking a look at the sales tax only for roads. And I think there's been many of us on the Democratic side who've been talking about the $2 billion of cuts that education saw 2 years ago by the governor and the legislature. And we said, for us to move forward as a state, we have to be investing in education. We all know that. And so I'm assuming that's actually, you know, come to the governor's attention and is one of the reasons why this new proposal is out there. I have not seen the details, so I can't really comment on the specifics of it. But I'll keep an open mind until I actually see the language and see what it contains.
Do you think you would be more apt to vote in favor of an increase in the sales tax if it covered both of those items as opposed to just the roads piece?
Well, I definitely have said publicly that I was concerned about just sales tax for the roads. I was more preferable to user fees because I think those who use the roads should pay the most for the repair of the roads. But if there is a balance where we can actually increase funding to education, I'll be open to it. But in the end, you know, to me, a sales tax is a regressive tax. And I would have preferred us taking a look at a variety of other areas within our budget to fund education and the roads. And, you know, again, we'll have these conversations this fall, and this will be one of the proposals that I'll entertain.
But the education option sweetens the deal for you?
again,
is it too early to say?
I think it's too early to say because until I actually say, what does that mean? Does it talk about K through 12? Does it talk about higher education, community colleges? I'd have to see the full proposal because, again, if you remember, 2 years ago, public universities took a 15% cut. You know, the K through 12 schools took that $2 billion cut. And so if we're getting them back to square one, perhaps that would help me move in the right direction. But until I actually see the details, I can't really say one way or the other.
We'll keep an eye on it. You are the vice chair of the committee that heard testimony on the funding of Common Core education standards, and a hearing on Wednesday included controversial remarks from Hillsdale College President Larry Arnn that I want to ask you about in a minute. But first, update us on where the Common Core discussion is right now from your perspective.
Sure. Just to let the listeners know, 3 years ago, the state of Michigan, through the Department of Education, approved the Common Core standards, and our local school districts for the last 3 years have been implementing them. In this last budget cycle, a small group of Republicans were concerned about those standards for a variety of reasons, and then they put a boilerplate language into the budget that said in October that we can no longer spend any dollars towards Common Core curriculum, Common Core standards and the curriculum that the local school districts will be creating as we move forward. So over the summer, we've been tasked with a committee of 11 of us to take a look at all the issues around Common Core with the hope that we can find a resolution in September so we can get to that October point and allow school districts and the Department of Education to actually spend money on the Common Core.
Is it your understanding that the concern over local control, which is what these conservatives are complaining about, was this an issue 3 years ago?
You know, they held public hearings at the state level on this issue. You know, obviously school districts have been implementing it, so I think many of us were surprised that it became an issue in the last 6 months. What has happened is a small group of Tea Party people nationally have made this an issue, and so the Tea Party has made that an issue here in the state of Michigan. On the House floor, I asked the Republicans who were in office, many of them, where were you 3 years ago when this was being implemented? Where were you the last three budget cycles that have allowed money to be put towards this? Again, this has become a national issue, and so therefore it had to find its roots here in Michigan as well. To me, I think it's a distraction. You know, they're claiming somehow that this was started by the federal government. There is no evidence of that. It actually was formed by the National Governors Association, mostly Republican governors. The business community has been supporting this because they want to have a set of standards across the country. So if you move your student from Michigan to Ohio in the second grade, they're going to be getting the same level of expertise because we want to position our students for a global economy.
And as you point out, Michigan schools began implementing these standards in 2010. What happens if this funding doesn't continue? What happens to that movement?
Well, that's what I think is most concerning to our local school districts. They're like, we've been doing this. Now what do you want us to do? Many of them spent a lot of money teaching their teachers on how to implement this. They've developed curriculum in their schools. And so the question is, are we going to be sending them backwards? And they're going to spend now more money on having to move in a different direction. And again, the other side hasn't said what standards should we be using. So then the question is, do we go back to the old standards that everyone, including conservatives, said that weren't good enough? And so it's a big question mark. No one expected this within the budget. It came in at the last minute, and it was a disappointment to many of us, both Republican and Democrat, and we hope that we can finish up our hearings in August and make some final resolution in September.
If a vote were held today, do you think it would pass or fail?
I think so. I think it would pass. Again, I think it was a small group of people who were holding up the budget, maybe not only for just this issue, but for other issues. And now that the full budget has been passed, that this was given on its own, I believe it will pass with bipartisan support, both in the House and the Senate.
Hillsdale President Dr. Larry Arnn, in his opening remarks on Wednesday, referred to the State Department of Education, and he said, quote, "They said we violated the standards for diversity because we didn't have enough dark ones, I guess is what they meant," unquote. What did you think when you heard Mr. Arnn's comment?
Well, I was surprised, and you could hear a gasp, actually, from the committee room. Because no one would expect a college president to refer to their minority students as dark ones. And it became even worse because there was another point in time where Chairman Kelly asked if he wanted to explain his remarks. And in the second response, he also uses the phrase dark ones again to refer to his minority students. And to me, I was disappointed. I know a number of my colleagues, afterwards demanded an apology from him. And I have to tell you that I saw the apology statement, which never contained an apology. And it almost was as offensive as his original remarks.
Well, Hillsdale College did offer an apology. We'll emphasize of sorts, and this is quite interesting. It said, "No offense was intended by the use of that term, except to the offending bureaucrats. Dr. Arne is sorry if such offense was honestly taken." The offending bureaucrats, presumably the Department of Education.
That might have done something 13 years ago that had nothing to do with the Common Core, which was interesting why he even brought that issue up. But the thing that I'm most concerned with that's not being discussed is that he was referring to the minority students on his campus as dark ones. So why has he not apologized to those students? I don't need an apology, but I do think that minority students would be offended that their college president believes that it's appropriate to be calling them dark ones.
It'd be curious. It'd be interesting to know what kind of discussion this has actually triggered on the Hillsdale College campus among the student body. Arne later explained that he made the statement because he didn't approve of the government interfering with how his private college is run. And it's true, Hillsdale College does not accept any state or federal funding. It's an anomaly, really. And Arne says he wasn't trying to insult the federal and state government officials who tried to document the races of Hillsdale students, which the college does not do. So I don't know what all that adds up to. It's a confusing situation.
It was, and of course, none of that had anything to do with the Common Core, which was what that testimony was meant for. So it was a shame that he diverted the attention of an issue that's important to the state of Michigan using language and rhetoric that's not appropriate in this day and age.
We're talking with East Lansing State Representative Sam Singh here on Current State. We don't often talk about Detroit with you, but congressional Democrats, this is U.S. Congressional Democrats from Michigan, Sandra Levin and others, are discussing ways to generate federal money for Detroit as it contends with its bankruptcy. Should the U.S. government be playing a stepped-up role? Have you thought about that?
I have. When you take a look at the difficulties the city of New York, though they never went to a formal bankruptcy they had in the 1970s, you take a look at other areas that have had similar types of problems. There's always usually been a federal, state, and then local solution to these. So I think it's very appropriate that the federal government take a look at this issue. But I think more importantly, I've not seen as much leadership as I would have hoped out of Governor Snyder on this issue. The governor has a role in municipal bankruptcies, and they can also tailor what they want to be looked at within these municipal bankruptcies. You know, one thing he didn't do early on is, as they went into bankruptcy, to say, I want to protect pensions. It actually took the Republican Attorney General to have to force that issue forward. He could have very easily put that within the bankruptcy filing. The big issue around the DIA, he again could have stated very clearly as part of that bankruptcy that we will not touch the assets of the DIA. Again, he's not done that. And then most recently, the poor community, county of Genesee yesterday was going towards receiving revenue bonds. And we're not able to receive any revenue bonds because investors have said the way that Detroit has been handled would potentially impact them. Kevin Orr very specifically said that he would not protect certain bonds through this process, which has been a traditional way of dealing with bankruptcies, because these revenue bonds actually have dollars coming into them, and those are one of the reasons why local municipalities across the state use them, because they are very sound investments. And what has now happened is an issue in Detroit and statements by Kevin Orr have now scared off investors who were potentially going to invest in Genesee County bonds. And now Genesee County, which is a very well-run county, has an A-plus rating, can't get the resources that they need. Again, the governor very clearly said, as they went into bankruptcy, this was not going to impact other communities. Well, it has, Governor. What are we going to do about it? And that's something I'm looking for this governor to take a strong stand on and tell his bankruptcy emergency financial manager to make statements that would help protect communities across the state of Michigan.
The day after, the morning after the Detroit bankruptcy was announced here on this program, there was a discussion of the domino effect. What's happened in Genesee County is part of that domino effect, in your view?
It is, and that's why one of the concerns that many of us had is that bankruptcy was the last possible solution for this problem, because it has the potential of impacting other communities and the bond ratings of the state. And there were things that the governor could have done, or he could have directed Kevin Orr to do, that he did not do, that is now negatively impacting the state. I believe he still has the opportunity to right the ship, and I expect that type of leadership out of him.
We've got less than 30 seconds, Sam, but I really want to ask you about the effort to reverse Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage that dates back some weeks now. You're part of that effort. Any movement there? What's the discussion like?
Well, again, we were all pleased to see the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. At the same time that week, we introduced a series of bills and resolutions that would take back to the voters in 2004's ban on that, and bring it back to the people for a vote, and we're hoping to hear about that in the fall.
Very good. Sam Singh is the Democratic East Lansing State Representative from the 69th District. Sam, good to see you.
Thank you very much.
For the past 20 years, little people from around the world have gathered every 4 years to compete in the World Dwarf Games. This year, the games are returning to their birthplace, East Lansing. And starting this weekend, short-statured children, adults, and seniors will play basketball, run track, and swim in the largest sporting event in history, exclusively for athletes with dwarfism. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spent some time with athletes getting ready for the games.
Take the ball and dribble between the cones, all the way down and all the way back.
There's nothing strange about a Sunday soccer practice at a neighborhood park in a Detroit suburb. But the black SUV slowly completing its third lap around the block might suggest otherwise.
Yeah, this is the part I was telling you about.
Confused glances. Chris Romano warned me this might happen. Good thing he has a sense of humor, his impression of the onlookers.
We're being invaded!
Invaded by dwarfs. 8 of them, all fierce female soccer players under the height of 4'5". Their coach,
Take it!
Chris Romano is also a little person, and he's preparing the team for the World Dwarf Games, where they will represent America.
USA!
Chris is a veteran of the competition. When he played, his best sport was basketball.
The game went down to the wire.
It was 1986 at the Little People of America Conference. At the time, the games were linked to the annual national event. In the gold medal match for basketball, Chris's team, the Michigan Centimeters, were tied with the LA Breakers. 11 seconds to go. Chris has the ball. He shoots, and he's fouled.
So I'm at the foul line, and I make my first foul shot, and that made the score 30-29. And then I turn around, and I look at the score and in the clock, and there's 11 seconds. Now I'm thinking this. I put a little pressure on myself. And what did I do? Of course, I missed that last free throw.
The other team takes the ball down, and
they threw up an air ball, and we won the gold medal. So it was pretty exciting. That was probably my highlight of any sort of game that I've been in.
Lansing resident Len Sawish is the founder of the Dwarf Athletic Association of America and a volunteer for this year's World Dwarf Games. He says creating memories like Chris's are why the games were started.
It is a matter of you never know how competitive you can be until you have a chance to be competitive.
The idea for a sporting event exclusively for dwarfs was first conceived right here at Michigan State University in 1985 as part of the Cerebral Palsy Les Autres National Games. After the competition, the Dwarf Athletic Association was created and sporting events became part of the annual Little People of America National Conference. Sawish again.
From there, we recruited enough folks with enough talent that we were able to send athletes in 1988 to the Paralympics. and we realized that there was an international stage, but there was nobody on it except us.
So in 1993, the first World Dwarf Games were held in Chicago, opening up the competition to short-statured people from all over the world.
My name's Sam Millard. I'm 25, and I'm from Melbourne, Australia. My first experience of the World Dwarf Games was in Belfast 2009, where Team Australia sent our first ever team to a World Dwarf Games, and I was participating in the basketball in 2009.
This year, the number of athletes from Australia has doubled. Sam says the response to the games have been so positive because the competition offers little people an opportunity they thought was only available to others.
When you're younger, like, you always look at the national teams and you think, wow, how great would that be? And it's kind of something that's unachievable. But to be able to do that and come to the other side of the world, represent your country, is something that we're all extremely proud of, and I'm extremely proud of.
That unachievable feeling is something 10-year-old Liam Smith of Rockford, Michigan, won't have to grow up with.
Okay, I'm doing archery, track and field, swimming, and floor hockey.
Today, Liam's practicing archery for the World Dwarf Games with Len Sawish. Len will also compete in archery this year.
But if I shoot 30 arrows, I'm pretty well done.
What?
I told you, I'm an old man, I don't have a stamina.
Liam has participated in tournaments around Michigan and the country since joining an archery club last year. For today's practice, he's decked out in full gear. Arm guard strapped over his forearm, quiver on his right hip, and over his left eye, a Jolly Roger stamped patch. Liam explains.
Okay. Well, I'm right-handed, but I'm left-eye dominant, so then we went to the eye doctor. They found out I was the other way, so then we're just going to keep it like that, so then I have an eye patch just to cover up the eye.
Liam's dad, Eric Smith, says he thinks the games will help boost Liam's self-esteem.
He knows that he's not the fastest kid out there, or he's not the kid that can throw the farthest or kick the ball the farthest, but he is going to be able to achieve a much greater sense of he can do things at these games.
And even at 10 years old, Liam is starting to understand what he's capable of.
Well, sometimes when I get bullied, it's like, well, and then they ask, like, why are you so short? I'm like, I have something in my genes that just makes me shorter, and I can still do a lot of stuff.
Len Sawish says that's the wonderful thing about the games. The genes don't matter. Neither does size or bullies or glares.
One of the most fascinating things, I think, about having World Dwarf Games is once you get here, there are no dwarfs. There's just athletes.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And with us now in the Current State studio to tell us more about the 2013 World Dwarf Games are Len Sawish. He's from Lansing and is the co-founder of the Dwarf Athletic Association of America. Hi, Len.
Morning.
And the Australian team captain, Sam Millard, who we heard in the story. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the USA.
Good to be here.
Is it your first time in the States?
It is, yes.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
We hope it's a great experience. As we just heard, nearly 400 athletes from 17 countries will be competing in a total of 14 sports over the next week here in East Lansing. And this is where it all began almost 30 years ago. Len, these games are your brainchild, as I understand. Tell us how these games got started way back when.
I was in the mix.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to play basketball. And they were holding the World Disabled Games in 1984, and some folks came to me and in my living room right here in Lansing and said, can we get some athletes with dwarfism to compete? I'm going, geez, that's a tough one, because for most of us, by the time, you know, you can play peewee sports and kids sports, but by the time everybody else hits adolescence,
you're out of it.
Yeah. Your athletic career is over in high school. I said, but If we could have some competition in the U.S. that would just put dwarfs against dwarfs, then I could probably get some people together. And in the back of my mind, I said, I could play basketball, put a basketball team together. So we couldn't get anything together for the World Games, but in 85, when the Cerebral Palsy Les Ultras Games were on campus, they offered us that opportunity. We brought 30 folks in, and it was such a life-changing event before we left campus, we said, we've got to continue to do this. And that's when we formed the Dwarf Athletic Association.
And it took off from there, and it's been...
Less than 30 years.
Onward ever since.
It's amazing. Less than 30 years. This is the sixth World Dwarf Games. Just blows me away.
Quite a trajectory.
Yes.
Lansing's very own Camille Wardell Black became the first little person to win a gold medal at the Paralympics.
That's right.
What was her sport?
She was a swimmer, and an amazing swimmer. And what's happened for us is that for the U.S., we've really dominated international swimming.
Don't say that around an Australian, because swimming and tennis, I know, are the traditional heavyweight sports in Australia. I think Sam's taking that as a challenge.
Challenge accepted.
When did Australia start fielding a team?
Australia first participated in Northern Ireland in 2009. So that was the first time on the world stage. We've been playing sport. Oh, short-statured sport back home for probably the last 20 years, but it was pretty much just basketball. I think it first started when two of our members went across to the LPA and the Dwarf Athletics Association games and participated there, then came back home and said, hey, we can do this too. So what Len's been able to do has definitely had an impact not only here but all around the world.
What percentage of the population are dwarves?
One in 30,000 births, roughly.
Okay.
I mean, ultimately, who's a dwarf is a political decision. If you do it strictly by size, and you say 4'10 or under, 5 foot or under, when I was a kid, it was always 4'10. Well, guess what? Every generation gets a little bit taller, a little bit taller.
Yeah.
Now we're going, okay, 5 foot. If you're under 5 foot, we'll call you a dwarf.
Now, these are the sixth games. They're back here in East Lansing, the biggest ever. 17 countries represented, including, of course, Australia. Sam, you've got 33 athletes here all together. What do you consider your team's strengths?
I think our team strength is the team. We've been together for 18 months now training, so the team's pretty solid together, and we're all in this together. We're going to support each other at events and... I'd say that would be the case. As far as events go, we're definitely looking forward to the swimming, of course, as you mentioned earlier. We've got a few strong swimmers here. The basketball is exciting, and it's the first time that we're fielding a soccer team, so we're looking forward to that.
And it's just your second time at the World Games, right?
That's right,
okay.
Yeah.
Started in 2009. Len, what about the Americans? 204 athletes, the biggest representation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's right here in our backyard. How could you not come? For a lot of the folks coming, this is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime activity,
yeah.
And they're not going to be able to do this, travel any other part of the world. So it's exciting to have it here. And if you could turn Sam's mic off for just a second. the U.S. delegation, quite frankly, lives in fear of Australia right now because they have been training for a good 18 months. They've been recruiting their team for 2 years. They're extremely focused, and they're frightening.
Dialed up, down, under. Holy cow, it sounds like it. Who's going to help your medal count here?
Our volume, 200 athletes. We're going to kick some Aussie butt.
By sheer numbers alone, you're going to dominate. Is that it? What about some of the other countries? Who else is well represented in this?
We've got the UK coming with, I believe, around 80 athletes.
Yeah, 84 athletes from the UK.
Yeah, so they did extremely well last time. Obviously, they had a larger contingent because it was only across the pond for them last time. But, they're extremely focused as well and been training hard. So.
Anybody coming for the first time?
Brazil will be coming in for the first
Brazil.
Time.
Brazil. There's a lot of serious athletes in Brazil.
Yeah, and they're the unknown. They're the wild card. We don't know any intelligence on what they're bringing and what they're going to be focused on. We're a little concerned about what they're going to do in soccer because the traditional powerhouses in soccer are the UK and the U.S.
We're talking with Len Sawish and Sam Millard of this weekend's or the next week's World Dwarf Games here in East Lansing, putting on your sports fan and spectator hats for a minute. What athlete or what rivalry are you most anxious to see over this next week? Sam?
I'm definitely looking forward to the soccer. In 2009, the Team GB and the US went to a penalty shootout. So that
GB,
was
Great Britain.
Yes, that's okay. Correct. Yeah, they definitely played a hell of a game back then, and I'm looking forward to seeing the same again.
Len, what about you?
I'm kind of interested to see what's going to happen in the pool. The U.S. has dominated the swimming for some time. The U.K. has been coming on, and the Australians look pretty tough. So I'm interested in that. I also like powerlifting. I just love seeing the dwarf athletes get up there and popping up three times their body weight. That's an exciting sport for me.
The Olympics have legends like Jesse Owens and Mary Lou Retton. There have been five dwarf games now, going back every 4 years to 93. Are there dwarf game legends over those two decades?
For me, having only gone in 2009, I can only speak from then, but we definitely created a few future legends back then. I think from an Australian point of view, we had Cullen Adams, who is a sprinter. He took out the 60-meter sprint, the 100-meter sprint, and just got pipped at the end of the 4x100 relay. So he did extremely well. And we also had Samantha Lilly taking out, I think, 5 gold in the pool. So, yeah.
Now, do you recall his time in the 100 meters? I'm just curious how long it takes to cover 100 meters for a little person.
I think it was roughly just under 15 seconds.
Okay, interesting.
I would have guessed a week. Well, for me,
you go back 20 years. What legends have you created?
I go back to the Chris Romano foul shot in 1986.
Tell us about it.
Beat those uppity folks from Los Angeles, came in with their great Lakers outfits on, and they were going to kick everybody around. And to watch them go down to the Detroit team was just an absolute delight. And then his son in Ireland did the same kind of a thing, where he won for the U.S. team on a last-second shot.
When and where will all these events be taking place, Len?
Well, each sport is at its own unique venue here on campus. And the schedule starts us off with track and field right after opening ceremonies, and we have swimming coming up on Sunday. Now, that's actually going to be in Mason, at the Mason Aquatic Center, because it's frankly a better pool than the MSU indoor pool, and it's designed for both international and national competition. One weighs yards, one weighs meters, so we're going to go down there for that. On Tuesday, it's my favorite sport. That's the day when most athletes kind of hit the wall, and so you don't do any formal competition. It's a recreation day. And I'm taking folks bass fishing at Lake Lansing. Got a little bass fishing tournament going on. That's going to be great fun.
Very nice. Do you have opening ceremonies? How does that unfold?
It's an international event. So, yes, we have opening ceremony, which will be tomorrow morning. And in the evening, we'll have an opening reception. We have a private VIP reception for our sponsors and supporters. We'll have a formal closing. The closing ceremony is going to be great, and I want folks to know that there's no charge for the opening or closing ceremonies or any of the sporting events, so come on down and watch us. The basketball finals, which in the U.S. is our big sport, will be in Breslin Center on Saturday the 10th in the early afternoon, and as soon as the basketball games are over, we'll do our closing ceremony right there in Breslin Center. So that's going to be an absolute kick.
Sam, what's it like to have these many dwarves congregate? What's that like socially?
It's definitely different for us from Australia. I think when we all get together, there's maybe 100 of us tops, and so coming over here where there's 400 plus little people all wandering around, it's definitely
what's that like? Yeah,
It's a different feel, and we had a chat as a team before we left about the possibility that people may be overwhelmed with that. I think even when we went to Ireland, there was athletes that went to the opening reception and wanted to walk straight back out just because they had never experienced anything like that. And it's something that is a challenge for some people, but at the same time, it's fantastic. It's fantastic to walk into a room where no one's staring at you, no one's making comments. Everyone just immediately understands things that others don't. So that's a fantastic feeling.
What is the single most special thing about these games for you, Sam?
The single most special thing would be seeing people achieve things that they never thought possible.
Len, when you started all of this back in 85 in your living room here in Lansing, what was your vision? You couldn't have imagined this.
No. didn't imagine this, just wanted an opportunity for kids in the U.S. to experience sport beyond adolescence.
Okay.
And it's just amazing. I didn't imagine this either. I didn't imagine that this sporting opportunity would create so many employment opportunities. Now we have dwarf athletic trainers. We have professional dwarf coaches. We have folks, little people who are in sports media and sports administration. It was never even considered 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and that's an offspring of all the sports.
How long do you intend to compete, Sam? Have you thought about that?
No, I'm just thinking about the next week at the moment. We'll see how the body recovers, and I might be back in 4 years' time.
Do we know where is it like the Olympics? Do we know where the 2017 games are, like 10 years out or something like that?
We hope by the end of the week to see who's going to step forward with bids, so we don't know yet.
Bids by the end of the week. You've stepped up. This sounds like intense 18-month training regimen that you've embarked on.
Yeah, it has been pretty grueling, and it's something that we all made a lot of sacrifices to be here today.
Len, how do you think it's all turned out?
Well, it hasn't turned out yet, but I hope it turns out really well for the U.S. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you win or lose. What matters is you have an opportunity to see where you fit. See where you rank with people like yourself. So I anticipate that everyone's going to have an excellent time, and even the losers are going to be winners.
Len Sawish is the co-founder of the Dwarf Athletic Association of America. Sam Millard is with the Australian Dwarf Athletic Team. The World Dwarf Games begin tomorrow, with the opening ceremonies at the Breslin Center continue throughout the Lansing area until August 10th. You can find a competition schedule and other information at 2013worlddwarfgames.org. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today. Good luck this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Lansing residents go to the polls next Tuesday to vote in their next primary election. Four incumbents on the city council are facing challengers, as well as Mayor Virge Bernero. In these final days leading up to the Lansing primary, Current State is examining the key races from the voters' perspective. Today we're talking about the race for two at-large seats on the Lansing City Council. The incumbents, Brian Jeffries and Kathy Dunbar, face four challengers. They are Ted O'Dell, Judy Brown Clark, Jonathan Smith, and Keith Smith. Here to talk about the issues and the job performances of at-large council members Brian Jeffries and Kathy Dunbar are two Lansing voters. We'll also talk about the challengers. Anita Beavers is a past president of the Colonial Village Neighborhood Association. Hi, Anita.
Hello.
And Catherine Mooney, who is president of Lansing's Northtown Neighborhood Association. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning, Mark.
Are there issues or topics that rise to the top for you as a voter, Anita?
Well, it's getting a council that works together is a very important part of what we're hoping to see.
Does the current council fall short, in your opinion, in that regard?
Sometimes, yes, it does.
Sometimes.
On some of the very important issue, there's quite a divide that seems to be persistent.
Is there an issue, though, that rises to the top? Beyond that, say, the cost of fire hydrants and street lights
That was one major issue. I think many of the voters felt that when the council worked so hard to have a budget and it was every item in there was vetoed by the mayor, I think that was a point where people thought, why are they not working together mm-hmm. at all?
Yeah. Catherine, what about you? What issues or topics rise to the top?
For me personally, I would say just advocating on behalf of the neighborhoods themselves and looking towards more project-based developments and ways to compromise between the private and public sector are what I'm looking for most when I'm considering our options for at-large candidates.
Okay. And tell us about your particular neighborhood. Who lives there? Where is it?
Oh, well, as Northtown neighborhood, we are on the north side of Lansing.
That much we figured
yes,
out.
Yes,
yes. But how big is it?
So we cover about 1,500 homes in the North Lansing area. We go from the point where Oakland and Grand River split out through the border of Grosbeck Golf Course over to Lake Lansing and then coming pretty much right up to Old Town there. So we make kind of a haphazard L shape right at the corner of the city there.
In the public-private initiatives that you mm-hmm. referred to a minute ago, would you say that is a common concern of the people in your neighborhood?
Oh, I would certainly say so. There has been a longstanding history, I think, in Lansing of public-private attempts at partnership that have ended up burning one party or the other. So at least in our neighborhood, there is a fair amount of fear when we start working towards new initiatives that someone will come in, take over the process, and that the neighbors themselves will lose their voice. And as a community where our neighbors have struggled to keep their voice and to make sure that they're heard consistently, making sure that we have voices on council that are listening to the actual residents, that are advocating their opinions when looking at these new developments. Is definitely a concern.
How accessible, Anita, do you feel Brian, the incumbents have been, Brian Jeffries and Kathy Dunbar, terms of accessibility?
They've always been accessible.
Okay.
Especially, I think, to the neighborhood associations. They attend our meetings and listen to our concerns. I feel that they... Almost every one of the council people is concerned about the neighborhoods, which I think at times is where the administration doesn't listen to what the council is saying about what the neighborhoods are looking for. And I think that part of the situation is what's lacking in getting things accomplished. Our neighborhood is one of about 1,400. And we have, it's an older established neighborhood.
This is the Colonial Village.
Yes. And it's, you know, there's the pre-war and post-war development, people moving up from living in apartments and moving into buying homes and then moving into larger homes. One of the things that, of course, has happened, and I'm sure it's all throughout the city, is when schools are closing, when you have... what's going to happen to the empty schools, that affects the neighborhood.
Right.
So we need a council and an administration that works with the Lansing schools to make sure that those buildings are effectively used and something like Nile Wave doesn't happen again. I think the council addressed that.
Are you talking about the structure or are you talking about the use of the school?
The use of the school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think also, I've known Mr. Jeffries for a long time. He's been involved in the area, in all areas, and he has always been someone who respects the neighbors, who listens, who is able to dissect what is happening and present a clear picture of what will happen if we do this.
Okay.
And I think one of the things that quite often happens is people don't look far enough ahead. They embrace something new coming in and say, oh, this will be so good. And then they don't realize, kind of like what happened with the rain gardens just recently.
Okay.
And things like that. And I think he's able to see what, if something happens, if we're going to do this, the casino, let's say, which I'm highly opposed to, what are the effects of that down the road?
We'll talk about the challengers here a little bit more in a minute. WKAR spoke with both Brian Jeffries and Kathy Dunbar about issues facing the city. Let's go to Brian Jeffries if we could here in our interviews. All of the interviews involved Lansing's very uncertain fiscal future. Let's listen to part of what Brian Jeffries said about that.
We're at a tipping point in the city of Lansing. People can no longer afford to live here in terms of the amount of fees that we're putting on them. The taxes are maxed out, at least in this city at this time. And so now we've got to figure out a way of, you know, being able to continue to provide those core services that people expect, public safety, keeping our parks open and being able to use our parks, roads and sidewalks, all of those issues that make, you know, an environment that people enjoy, that want to raise their families and want to live here.
Catherine Mooney, does that huge challenge for the city play any role in your voting decisions?
Oh, most certainly it does. I mean, the recent cutbacks that have happened with city services over the past several years have had a great impact on our neighborhood, especially when we look at what options are available for extracurricular activities for youth, both in the school district and just around the Parks and Recs department. It absolutely does. What I think my personal biggest emphasis point is that, yes, while we're looking at the fact that we are on a tipping point financially for the city, while we do have a lot of tough decisions that we're making, I want to make sure that my voice on council is not coming at it from a place of what if something goes wrong, or, you know, perfecting things to death or making sure that we have thought 20 years in advance. We need to work towards those things, but we can't be afraid to fail forward, and we can't be afraid to try new things. And so that's my biggest concern, that as we're coming up to this tipping point, we have hard decisions to make, obviously, but we have to make sure that those decisions are made responsibly and with the understanding that if we take a wrong step in our pursuit of good outcomes, that's okay and that we can step back on the path. And that's something that I haven't seen very much from Mr. Jeffries in the past, is a willingness to kind of take a step out of line with the understanding that we can correct and move forward if necessary.
Does the fiscal predicament that can't bode very well for your concern over initiatives in the Northtown neighborhood?
You know, we're the North Side, man. We do it ourselves.
Okay.
That's our goal, right? Like, we're pretty used to not having support in city services over there.
Okay.
So. For us, these new fiscal concerns are just one more realization that neighbors have to come together to do what neighbors need to do for each other.
I detect kind of a go-it-alone kind of attitude there.
Well, the good news is with 1,500 homes, you don't feel very alone.
Okay. Let's get into a comment that we got from Kathy Dunbar as well, who is also one of the at-large. Let's clarify which wards you live in, though. First here. Catherine, what ward do you live in?
We're in the first ward, represented by Councilwoman Jody Washington.
Okay, Jody Washington in the first. Anita, what about you?
Well, we have an interesting situation. We are divided now. We have Aileen and Jessica Yarko.
Okay, so you're part in the fourth, mm-hmm. and part in Aileen Rod, and that is which one?
The third.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to a comment Kathy Dunbar, one of the other incumbents, made here to WKAR, she brought up a recurring topic, the perception of the city council as dysfunctional.
An innocent bystander coming into the city, flipping through the channels on any given night, seeing dysfunction occur on the television is not good for anyone involved. Seeing the fights between certain factions in the mayor's office, seeing the fights that happen among council members on the floor, there's a respect that needs to happen on all sides, and on many occasions it doesn't happen, and it plays out very, very dysfunctionally.
Anita, this plays off on your very first comments here this morning. You would like to see a more cohesive council, so I'm inclined to think you're on board with everything Kathy Dunbar just said.
Yes, I am. I think the need to have a council that works together is the most important thing for having the city reach its goals.
I mean, there are two,
there are two factions.
There are two blocks on the city
right.
council. Who needs to be working with whom,
I
can put it that way?
Well, actually, they all need to be working with each other. I think it's important that when a council forms an opinion as a group. And then we have the dissenters who tend to, and this is pretty much what people perceive, that there are several people who will go with the mayor. And then there are the, and so there's that swing that happens, and it's commonly thought, all right, the mayor's going to get his way because he has the people that will follow him. I feel that sometimes we need that dissenting group, that group that is with the administration, to stop and realize that it's the council's job to work as a group.
But what I heard you say at the beginning was that what I took you to mean was that both sides need to come closer to the middle.
They need to bring themselves together and present a unified picture of how they see the city moving forward. I often see them having a problem with the administration presenting all the information. I don't know how often it happens, but they'll be asking for information and they don't have it. They'll get some, and it's last minute from the administration. So they're having to work hard to make decisions. And I feel sometimes that it's just a matter of when and how can you work together instead of continuing to say, no, it's going to be my way.
Let's move on quickly to one of the challengers. Current State reached out to all four challengers running for at-large council seats. We received no response from Jonathan Smith, Keith Smith, and Judy Brown Clark. But we did hear from Ted O'Dell, politically quite an active guy and pretty experienced in local and county politics around Michigan. One of his comments was, our city government must strive every day to find ways to create more jobs inside the city of Lansing without giving continued outrageous corporate tax abatements. Catherine, are the corporate tax abatements the city's offering outrageous?
I mean, I think you have to look at it abatement by abatement, right? Anytime you have tax breaks, in my opinion, that go out to a private organization, you can judge the level of ridiculosity, if you will, based on the level of accountability that's placed to go along with those abatements. So if we're going to be giving private organizations the freedom to not pay into our coffers as a city, then we also need to be holding them to very strict standards as to what their behavior and accountability measures are to the residents and to the city themselves.
We have to leave it at that, unfortunately. Catherine Mooney, president of Lansing's Northtown Neighborhood Association, Anita Beavers, past president of the Colonial Village Neighborhood Association. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Current State Weekend, join host Emmanuel Berry for arts and culture coverage, including a conversation with Garrison Keillor and a look at Steve Miller's new book, Detroit Rock City. That and more on Current State Weekend. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by M3 Group, a full-service branding agency as well as publisher of Greater Lansing Business Monthly and Capital Area Women's Lifestyle Magazine. Information on services and publications at m3group.biz. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu